Would you kill your papa to save your mama? A lesser man would have stopped there, seeing tears already threatening to wet the child's cheeks. Would you kill your papa and Bapa Jules to save your mama? He pressed. Papa and Jules and me, would you kill me? And Ibis and Ken and Mycroft? He nodded to the rest of us in the circle. The Hobosh, then, Ibis suggested, 9 years old, crazy about animals and already loving me like more than family. We'd do anything for the Hobosh. Would you kill a different Bosh to save this one? Yes, Ken answered instantly. He was 6 years old, a sponge for history, and inseparable from the wooden training sword which he dragged behind him like a teddy bear. I would. I'd also die for it. Easy to say, Ken Marty, but not easy to do, was it? I left you your katana and one hand intact with which to wield it, a way to end your pain, and I even promised to end your parents' suffering if you did the deed. Your mother was brave enough, Kohaku Marty. When he felt the agonies of my poison setting in, he slit his belly with a calm to make his ancestors proud, and, woman of iron, even wrote the message in his own blood, 33-67, 67-33, 29-71. You, though, who had boasted yourself a modern samurai, you watched the Arctic around you turn the scattered pieces of your limbs to ice and dropped your sword and cried and suffered to the end. Hypocrite. Geneva's lesson was not done. How about two other Boshes? He pressed. Would you wipe out two Boshes to save ours? If I had to, how about three? Four, 10 Boshes. How many is too many? Or let's count people. 500 people? 1,000 people? 1 billion people? 1 billion is too many, Laurel judged with his air of princely authority. 1,000 is too many, too, even 100. One more than there are members in the Bosh is too many. Ibis shook her head. Killing anyone at all is too many. Killing one more than there are in the Bosh is when it turns from too many to too many. Have you ever heard, reader, such a nauseatingly cousinly sentiment? She would have been one, never doubt that, had I let her live. Then the Bosh still isn't something you'd do anything to save, is it? Geneva asked, eager to see what the children would try next. He never lost that calm, even when he hung dying on the cross, when I visited him to hear his last philosophy, which grew pure and more penetrating as sun and thirst helped him toward his God. It was Laurel, already thinking like a statesman, who thought of the world. To save the world, the human race, you'd have to do anything for that, anyone would. Ken was duty-bound to criticize his rival. That's stupid. Of course you'd do anything to save the world. The world includes everything and you. So whatever you have to give up to save it would be destroyed anyway if you don't, so there's no real sacrifice. You have to do anything to save the world, there's no choice. No choice? Apollo was with us too. Apollo Mojave, 25, the hood of his utopian coat thrown back so the sun could lend gold to his hair, though it hardly needed more. I don't know what Sen Marty was doing, that Apollo was with us and not with her, but I remember him stretched out on his back, his coat mimicking the grass beneath, so he seemed like a spirit, only half-born out of the earth, still wrapped in nature. Would you destroy a better world to save this one? We were children, reader. We did not have our answers yet, not even I. But I do not present this memory as a lesson. Rather, it is a sample of what the Marty children went through every day with Geneva and the others, Kohaku, Senator Aeneas, the historians McKenna, Gia, Chiesa, Jules, the brillest fellow Mercer, Lee, who could almost outmother her old boss Sib, Briar Kosala. Tully was not with us. Tully, who was then just born, an infant when we were already imbibing harshest ethics, Tully was 8 years old when I killed the others, as I was 8 when the explosion deprived me of a birthbash I hardly remember. Tully knows nothing, reader, and what he does know is more a second-hand reconstruction built from interviews and old notes than real memory. Still, even if it was just a shell of what the Mardis were, a feeble echo of the words which must not be, which he poured out now into the streets of Barcelona, phalanx upon phalanx, I would have done anything to silence him. But that's just one majority, Tully continued. I could see him standing literally on a soapbox on the street corner, pleading with the passers-by like an ancient doomsday preacher. There's another. The Masons are growing. You've seen the numbers. 3 billion Masons, 3.1, 3.2. If they grow, the others shrink. 1.7 billion cousins, 1.2 billion Europeans, barely a billion Brillists. They're sucking away the population, and everyone worries, how long until my hive drops below a billion? Below half a billion? When my children grow up, will their hive be as rare as Utopians? The majority fears the Masons, wants to strike back, to cut their numbers, see them shrink again. You get angry when you see a young person in the white suit of the Annus Dei Legorum, don't you? When you debate with them, you don't try equitably to help them decide. You work actively to dissuade them. You think the Masons haven't noticed? You think they don't realize that the larger they grow, the more hostile the majority becomes? How long until they start to defend themselves? Tully, at least my mind could recognize in this vague haze of the present. 13 years hiding on the moon had left Tully Mardi tall and artificial, muscles cultivated by prescribed routines rather than play, sustained on a diet rationed milligram by milligram. Childhood's departure had left his hair brown and his face lively and academic like his Brillist mother's, but I saw nothing of his father there, nothing of the eternal grin of Luther Mardi Gras. A true Mardi Gras, born and raised, professional party thrower, who could turn 4 people locked in an elevator into a festival and tempt even Utopians to stray. As if to mock his forefather's happy trade, Tully's face was all urgency, lips which had tasted many vitamins but never candy. He was 22 now, old enough to imagine himself a man but not a Utopian. That step he would not take. He wore no coat, no visor, just a loose blue shirt and gray pants, neither sloppy nor formal, and a gray law hiveless sash, calculated to make him seem as generic as possible. Everyone can listen to an everyman. Don't you see it can't last? He kept on preaching, words pouring out as from a broken dike. Why did the French Revolution happen? Because a scattering of nobles took up all the land and oppressed the majority. Don't say it, I mouthed, silent, to myself, to God, to no one. Why did the Roman Empire fall? It grew too big, too unwieldy, ignoring the strength and hate and envy of its majority neighbors. Don't let them say it. It's happening already all around us. The property flows first, blood later. It's going to happen. It is happening. Saladin, don't let them say it. War. I'm talking about war, revolution, riots. You think it can't happen? That without nations, without armies, there can't be war? We have police. Their force is enough. It can happen, and it will. You think violence has died out of our society? Look at Mycroft Canner. Look at all the followers that still worship Mycroft Canner. You think the world that made them can't make war? It's still in us. the death instinct, the willingness to kill. It's Mycroft Canner. Shaking, Tully raised his hand to point at me. That's them. There, in the hat. That's Mycroft Canner. The first moment of a crisis is most precious, but I wasted it. I wasted it seeing. I could see now Tully's audience, 4 Brillists, 2 Masons, 2 Humanists, and a Mitsubishi, stopped in their tracks by this peculiar, scrawny hiveless on his high-tech crutches. I think it was the soapbox that attracted them, mad in this world where text and video can reach a billion at once. The live performance was powerful. The realization that he was speaking not to masses, but to them, words with only one chance to persuade, or fail and perish. They listened. Not millions skimming the net, but 9 live witnesses as Tully raised his hand to point at me. Mycroft Canner, he repeated. It's them. They've come to finish the job. Get them. 9 people would not have been enough to become a mob. But there were ringleaders waiting. 4 of them, posted around Tully's podium like guards with metal pipes and baseball bats hungry in their hands. We knew you'd come. You're dead, Canner, you hear? You're dead. Run. I seized the nearest of my fellow servicers and shoved them toward the alley behind us. Run, all of you! A few obeyed, but most stayed, massing around me as if their brittle bodies could have done anything to block such rage. It didn't matter. Before they saw me spring, I was past them, past my attackers, bounding along the street with a perfect synchrony of arms and legs that transformed the whole of my height to speed. My old self laughed, seeing the others' faces as they watched or tried to watch. Imagine, reader, in primordial days, some vicious dinosaur, heavy with nightmare jaws, which chases a shimmering lizard up a slope, and the predator rejoices, already tasting the kill in its blood-starved mind, when, all at once, its slim prey spreads its feathered fins and takes to the air, in a world that had not yet realized life could fly. You dare try to catch me? Now, play it now. They knew their enemy, my enemies. They had prepared the basest and best of traps for me. Canner beat. I don't know where the speakers were, but they blasted it loud enough for the beats to vibrate through my bones. I lost this shadow world, and was again in my 2 weeks, Ibis Mardi writhing beneath me, charred and already half-carcass as a red-hot crowbar punished blow by blow that brazen bitch who dared imagine she might claim the heart which belongs only to Saladin. I had speculated, when I decided to use my pacemaker to leave behind records of my heartbeat as I experienced the thrill of every kill, about what uses doctors and Brill's Institute would make of the tapes. But I so underestimated human genius that it never occurred to me that people might make art. Any rhythm can become a song. The accelerations, retards, and crescendos of my heartbeat, backed by fierce harmonics and suitably bloody lyrics, have spawned a genre and a culture of their own. I would like Canner Beat, I suspect, if I could hear it. But the rhythms strip me of all present tense and plunge my senses into replay. I tasted Ibis's meat again, felt hot blood spatter on my skin as she flailed at me with the shreds I had left of the hands which had too often clutched possessively at mine, and I saw Saladin's loving smile as we consummated our revenge. My opponents chose well. I tumbled blindly to the ground, barely awake as my attackers raised their bats around me. I was rescued in that moment by a kind of U-beast called a pillar cat. It is feline, but long like a snake, with 6 pairs of legs all in a line, each a full cat's length apart, so it can wrap its purring coils around your ankles 3 times over, or nap on your belly wound in a spiral which overflows you like a living blanket. This one was green, a lively new leaf green with a golden underbelly and a constant purr which almost masked the hum of electronics underneath.